Speaking of Liberty.
Speaking of Liberty, the National Broadcasting Company takes pleasure in presenting the first of another series of programs under the auspices of the Council for Democracy. Once again, there will be free talk by free men every week at this time. And once again, our host is Rex Stout. Well, most of you already know Rex Stout as the author of baffling mystery stories and as brain parent of the corpulent criminologist Nero Wolfe. On these programs, you will come to know him even better as an outspoken champion of our American democracy. Mr. Stout.
Thank you, George Putnam. Good evening, friends of liberty, and enemies, if any. Our guest this evening is no enemy of liberty, but a true and tried and gallant friend. Carl Carmer has written books, Stars Fell in Alabama, The Hudson, Listen for a Lonesome Drum, and currently a series of articles telling the story of civil liberties in America. He has just finished another book called Genesee Fever, which will appear in a month or two. And if it's as good as his others, anyone who doesn't read it will be missing something. What about it, Mr. Carmer? Is it as good as your others?
So much better, Mr. Stout.
Well, nobody can say we don't allow freedom of speech on this program, permitting an author to plug his own book. And now, Mr. Carmer, how about a plug for civil liberties, freedom of speech included, particularly civil liberties in a time of crisis? On the train this morning, I heard a man asking another man, what are we going to do with the American fascists? If he'd been asking you, how would you have answered him?
What are we going to do with the American fascists? Why, nothing. Our country doesn't do things with its free citizens.
Well, suppose you happen to think that the actions and utterances of American fascists are a real threat to our future and our institutions.
That isn't the point, Mr. Stout. It happens that I do regard them as a threat, but that has nothing whatever to do with it. The American fascists are free-born citizens of a free country and are entitled to express their views as often and as openly as they like. That's what being a citizen of a free country means. I'm entitled to do the same thing. We couldn't do it in a totalitarian country, of course, but we can do it here. In a democracy, the right to disagree, to state one's free opinion, is fundamental.
Certainly, Mr. Carmer. We are speaking of liberty. And free speech is one of the four basic freedoms. But even they, the dearest and best of all rights, are not absolute. Even they have their exceptions, or at least their qualifications. Would you say that the principle of free speech extended to a man falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater and causing a panic?
It's odd that you should bring up that particular example, Mr. Stout.
Why so?
Because it was also brought up by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Probably plagiarism, I hope unconscious. Chief Justice Hughes...
It wasn't Hughes. It was old Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. And he brought up the Man in the Theater case to illustrate where the guarantees of the Bill of Rights should and should not apply.
What did he say?
Well, I don't remember the exact words, of course, but the general idea goes like this. If a man's words or acts tend to create a clear and present danger of evil results, such as panic, he's no longer protected by his constitutional right to free speech.
And if he isn't protected by it, he hasn't got it. And there's your exception. Whereas, if there isn't any clear and present danger, there'll be time for full and free discussion. So no matter how incendiary or dangerous a man's words may be, the general good sense of the people at large will be able to offset them. What are you looking for, Mr. Carmer?
A memorandum I made. I thought I brought it along. Here it is. When you told me we'd been talking about civil liberties and free speech, I thought I might as well come prepared. This is something the late, great Justice Brandeis said, and I think it expresses the principle perfectly. May I read it?
Please do.
I quote Justice Brandeis. Those who won our independence by revolution were not cowards. They did not fear political change. They did not exalt order at the cost of liberty. Two courageous, self-reliant men with confidence in the power of free and fearless reasoning applied through the processes of popular government, no danger flowing from free speech can be deemed clear and present unless the incidence of the evil apprehended is so imminent that it may befall before there is opportunity for full discussion. If there be time to expose through discussion the falsehood and fallacies, to avert the evil by the processes of education, the remedy to be applied is more speech, not enforced silence. Such must be the rule if authority is to be reconciled with freedom. Such, in my opinion, is the command of the Constitution. I think that answers fairly completely the question of your friend on the train.
It does. But there are other questions. I think I am historically justified in asking for another exception. In ordinary times, the opinion you just read covers the situation. But what about a period of emergency? What about times when our whole future is at stake and our enemies are working against us on our own soil, more or less undercover?
Those are just the times when free speech is more necessary than ever, Mr. Stout. It's the only way a democracy can sift all the issues and arrive finally at a course of action. And sometimes, even when the course of action is decided on, the restraints can be voluntary instead of legal. Look at England today. Bomb-racked and war-torn as it is, no civil liberties have been abrogated. The people themselves have voluntarily and patriotically surrendered some of their civil rights because of the need for unity in the war effort. Labor, for instance, has the right to strike, but has given it up for the time being. And if you want an example from our own history, even during the Civil War between the states, Abraham Lincoln did not suspend the country's civil liberties, except in a very few cases.
Didn't he? What about Vallandigham?
Vallandigham talked for almost 3 years before he was finally arrested. And even then, Lincoln remarked that he doubted if it was really necessary. And there were a lot of others besides Vallandigham who kept right on talking. Of course, there were a good many cases in various military districts where free speech was suppressed and where newspapers were forced to discontinue. But in general, the Copperheads and the Northern Democrats kept crying for peace and accusing Lincoln of being a dictator right up to the end of the war.
That sounds familiar. What did Lincoln say when they called him a dictator?
He said he could imagine a sick man having to take emetics while he was sick, but he doubted if the same man would have a taste for them after he got well. He said he guessed the American people could be trusted to take back any rights they gave up during a time of rebellion and invasion.
And he was right, as usual. But I'm still after that second exception. Propaganda has, of course, always been a weapon, ever since the serpent used it on Eve. But its modern techniques and methods, compared to those of the last century, are like a machine gun compared to a squirrel rifle. Have you read Mein Kampf and Hitler's speeches, Mr. Carmer, where he boasts of his intention and ability to have his path cleared for him in each country by certain citizens of that country? Specifically including the United States of America? What about these path clearers? What do we do about them?
I stick to my original answer, Mr. Stout. Absolutely nothing. That is, nothing repressive. Of course, I believe we should talk back to them, try to show them and their followers the error of their ways. While the country is in a state of emotional excitement, before the final decision has been taken, everyone must be allowed to say exactly what he thinks, whatever his motive. And so far as enemy propaganda is concerned, I think we have the perfect answer right here in our own United States.
Meaning what? Our free press?
Our free press and much more. Our press, our radio, our magazines, our books, our public speakers. I doubt if any country in the history of the world was ever so well prepared to meet propaganda and recognize it at first sight. Also, don't forget that any new weapon is terrifying only at first. Poison gas filled Canadian troops with horror at Ypres, and whole battalions of Germans broke when they first saw tanks along the Somme in 1916. I think it's just the same way with propaganda. Last year, it was something peculiarly devilish that crept up on us while we slept. Today, it's just something else, a new and annoying weapon, to be sure, but something which we have learned to meet.
I'm not so sure about that, Mr. Carver. Curiosity killed a cat. And it is quite possible that complacency could kill the American eagle. But I want to catch you up on something you let drop just a minute ago.
I'm like a member of Parliament, Mr. Stout. I insist on having notice of these questions.
Oh, this isn't bad. In saying that everyone should be allowed to say just what he thinks, you use the phrase, before the final decision has been taken. Does that mean that in your view a time does come when suppression of free speech is permissible?
That's a fair question, and it goes right to the heart of what we're talking about. I'll say a reluctant yes. I do think that a time might come when a partial suspension of a civil liberty would be justified. And I say that in the full realization that I'm on dangerous ground. Many thoroughgoing Democrats won't agree with me. They'll say that no conceivable situation justifies suppression of the Bill of Rights.
Not me. I think that's extreme.
I agree. I go back for my own justification to my friend Justice Holmes. That is, if I can find another memorandum.
What's this one?
Let's see. Oh, yes. When a nation is at war, many things that might be said in time of peace are such a hindrance to its effort that their utterance will not be tolerated so long as men fight, and that no court could regard them as protected by any constitutional right. That's Justice Holmes. And of course, anybody would agree that you couldn't let people say anything that would give aid and comfort to the enemy.
And equally, of course, you are justified in shutting them up if what they say involves a clear and present danger of immediate disaster, like the man in the theater. Well, now, if I understand your position, Mr. Carmer, you believe in the complete maintenance of all civil liberties, that is, the four freedoms guaranteed under the Bill of Rights and the Atlantic Charter, except in cases where the nation is at war. Is that correct?
Not entirely. I want to qualify that. Some time may come, naturally, when someone must make a decision on suspension of a right to which we are accustomed. I'd say that the proper authorities to make the decision are the properly elected representatives of the people, either the Congress or the President, and that the only justifiable time is following a declaration of war or a declaration that a state of war exists, when our representatives agree that the country's war effort is endangered by expressions of opinion hostile to
now,
it.
Now, watch your step, Mr. Carmen, as you visit Vermont over the holiday.
I'll steer clear of war-torn lands. Does my definition of convenience and necessity make sense, Mr. Staff?
Perfectly, Mr. Carmen. I think anybody would agree that when a nation is involved in a war, it is justified in refusing to tolerate actions or utterances calculated to hamper or interfere with the war effort. That's the second exception I was after.
And on the other hand, I want to make my qualifying clauses very clear and very strong. No suppression of our civil liberties is justified unless two conditions are met. First, that the country is actually at war. And second, that our elected representatives, all of whom we trust are ardent believers in the four freedoms, decide that a particular exercise of a particular liberty is actually harmful to the war effort. You can't go around seeing dangers wherever you look for them, shutting people up because you happen to think that they're saying that what they're saying is dangerous to the national welfare. That's too easy. Also, it involves setting your private opinion of what is and isn't dangerous against the other fellows. As events turn out, he may be more nearly right or more nearly in accord with the national view than you are. A war effort may be immeasurably improved by adverse criticism. No, Mr. Stout, we can't afford to suppress our freedoms until the last possible hour, and we must take care to get them back as soon as the danger is over. But during the time of actual war, and only when honest American believers in the Bill of Rights consider that the cause is imperiled, then unity of effort becomes more immediately important than individual liberty.
I'm glad you add that point about getting them back. You don't anticipate any difficulty about that?
Not at all. I agree with Lincoln. When we give up our freedoms, we do it reluctantly and for a strictly limited time. We can never afford to forget, and I'm sure we never will, that as Stephen Benet has said, freedom's a hard-bought thing.